John Kennedy. It is more an effort to teach you to read your own newspapers, things that are pertinent to all those assassinations. We'll talk about them this week. We won't go back to the past. We'll start with this week's news that was in your papers pertinent to each of these assassinations. But I think you should take down pencils if I mentioned book titles or names or dates or newspaper dates that you can look up in the library. I don't want you to believe what I am saying necessarily. I want you to look for yourself and begin to see for yourself, because it is all there. You know, we talk about the news not giving us information, and yet there's a tremendous amount of information. Even with all that's withheld, just get a picture of what's going on in this country if you begin to see it right.
Right. I know. I have a new way I read my newspaper.
Really?
It's surprising the number of things that you pick up that you do. And that I didn't ordinarily.
I'll know that you're really hooked when you sit down with a scissors and a pencil and read your newspaper and a stapler.
I was watching you read
the
your
back
paper
page
today.
Is always stapled to the front page, and except the Monterey Herald, they put the news from first to second page, and it always bothers me because they're back to back. But the other, the Chronicle and the Mercury, I take six papers a day. I used to take eight. My research, we discussed this on the first dialogue, the basic research is done from the commission hearings before the Warren Commission met in Washington. And they had hearings of 552 witnesses. And from those hearings, they wrote up what they called the Warren Report. And the first 15 volumes are witness testimony to the assassination of John Kennedy. And the last 10 volumes are exhibits, FBI reports and Secret Service reports, State Department papers. And as we said earlier, I took all of the documents that have no table of contents or index or any sense at all. They jump around from every possible place, from Oswald's grades in the fourth grade and fifth grade to State Department to Ruby and autopsies and all kinds of things. There's no order, and each volume is almost 1,000 pages of small print. So it took me 6 years to complete the research that I needed to write several books, five books right now, each on a different subject. But I do read the daily newspapers, because if it was a conspiracy to do these murders, then certain people got into positions of power, political power, that they wouldn't have had otherwise. So the new weekly news is very important to the assassinations.
So then in this week's news...
Well, this week's news...
You have assassinations, but... The United States becoming a second-rate nation by political blackmail?
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I said right away is that Oswald, I knew from, I say right away, that's like 3 years ago, knowing for sure that he had been an agent of the CIA, I knew that when he came home from the Soviet Union, he brought his wife with him, who was from Russia, and that they were meeting people in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that were important to this military coup. And the minute Oswald was killed, the Soviet Union, Pravda and Izvestia, said that we knew all along he was an agent in the Soviet Union. And I feel that he had to be a double agent. If they knew he was an agent and they let him come home and meet with all these right-wing people in the, and I don't mean as a slur, I mean politically they were very far right, and this is documented. He was not with communist sympathizers in the Dallas-Fort Worth area by any stretch of the imagination. One man, Max Clark, was in charge of security at Convair, ex-FBI man, in charge of security at Convair. That was the first man he called when he arrived in Fort Worth. They say through the library, but it never could be documented who set up the source of contacts of Oswald with the chief of security from Convair. But the point is, in order to leave the Soviet Union, if they knew he was an agent, they had to let him out and on the process of being a double agent, which complicates the scene a lot. But the fact remained that knowing what they did about Lee Oswald after our political assassinations, the Soviet Union could blackmail us into making us a second or third or tenth rate nation. And I have in writing to public officials all over the country letters saying that only by telling the truth about the assassination would we remain a first rate nation, because then they would have nothing on us. And just this week in the New York Times, I just cut it out, there's a group in the United States, I've never heard of them, called the Committee to Unite America. It's a patriotic American group, and they claim the United States is in danger of becoming a second-rate power, subject to political blackmail and intimidation by the Soviet Union. And I think that's absolutely right. I don't even know of any more clear way to put it, and it was in the news this week, that they will bring us down. Blackmail, again, we got together the first time because of the Pentagon papers that were disclosed, and that was a form of blackmail, taking these secret papers and saying, now I'm going to show you what you really are. I've tried to ask you to do it intelligently. You wouldn't do it. I'm going to spill the beans. And that's in every public official we have around the world, Mr. Kissinger and Richard Helms and Spiro Agnew. And everybody had to leave and make a peace overture for the first time. All the Paris peace talks, all the conversations on peace and getting along would not work. The minute this thing spilled out, we sent these people, Melvin Laird, all of them, to every country that was important to us. And now they're talking peace.
Right.
So that is the...
Well, if you have no secrets, you have nothing to worry about.
That's right.
Everything's out front. Why?
That's right.
You got it made.
Then when it all spills out, these men went out with a flurry. And now Richard Nixon has to do a complete about face on the China thing, you know, that he's always had. And everybody's flabbergasted. But I'm sure that all the meetings and arrangements had to do because the Pentagon Papers, what the men said in private and who's doing it, where the agents are located. There's an article in the New York Times this week that Washington had to stop the Pentagon Papers for this short period of time. Their excuse was national security, and now that Richard Helms says there were agents in strategic places, I can't believe it, that a paper that was completed in 1968 would endanger certain agents that are out now. But the point is the blackmail, the putting it on the line, will give us peace in the world.
Do you want to talk next about the war study of the Soviet Journal?
Well, yes. You know, the very first time we met, and it can, for those of you that have listened to the other dialogues, I think you can appreciate some of this repetition, because a lot of the things that I'm saying here are new, and they're new to your frame of reference or thought, or you felt them, but you haven't had the names or the places to back up what you really felt inside. People say, I agree with you, or this is the way we talk at home, husband and wife, and I'm getting reaction of people who, a real gut feeling, you know, like, right on, you're telling us the truth. So some of this we're going to have to repeat from time to time, and the very first time we got together, and the reason to get together was the problem of holding power. We said the name of the game was power. And once again, I'm trying to be objective, and I'm not trying to push, again, the Soviet news onto what our thinking is, but I have to quote some of the articles that are coming out of the Soviet Union, because this is what it's all about, a power game between us and the communist world. And I think that sometimes outsiders see us differently than we see ourselves. Our neighbors see us, our friends see us. And we can't take lightly what they're telling the rest of the world. And they came out and decided that the reason the Vietnam Papers, the Pentagon Papers, came out at this time was that there was a power struggle in the United States between two groups. And this is what the military coup was in Dallas of 63, a power struggle between two groups. And the Russians say that the power in the United States is divided between the Eastern Seaboard, General Motors, U.S. Steel, Corning, and the large Eastern Ivy League group, and another group which they call the Vietnam sector, the nuclear rocket space sector in the military industrial forces. Now, my research, not through the documents that I read, the 26 volumes, but because I read those documents, people brought me from the Southwest, from Texas, and I mentioned some things were brought to my home, the opinion based upon inside information that the Defense Intelligence Agency was central in the assassination, along with the Space Rocket Group. And Mr. Dornberger, who was a Nazi who came over from Germany with Mr. von Braun, who is vice president of Bell Aerospace in Fort Worth, Dallas area. One of his helicopter designers, Michael Payne, was the home where Lee and Marie Oswald lived. And I have the names of the lawyers that represent all the assassination people who come in on James Ray or even Manson, Charlie Manson, which was a political murder. We'll take one evening just on that. And all of the political murders, the same lawyers are sent from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, from the space group, or assigned from there. And the Soviet Union's remark this week. It was in your Monterey Herald. The Vietnam sector of the nuclear rocket space sector, it is conflicting with the Eastern Seaboard. We did say that I didn't believe how any person could run for president in the United States anymore who represented the real will of the masses, unless there was a groundswell that they do want to be represented. And I do think there was a coup in Dallas. No, there was in 63. And this study now of why the stories are breaking, you see, Robert McNamara worked with John Kennedy, and he worked with the Pentagon. But there was advice, there were tape recordings of his voice, there were studies done that he didn't even know were being done behind his back. And this is all coming out.
Oh, boy. I understand, I didn't see it, but I understand Bob Considine wrote an article entitled The Shooting of JFK, A Wild Accident, question mark.
Yeah. A new theory.
A new theory, right. I looked just briefly at the clipping that you had, and it inferred that perhaps Oswald was aiming at Conley and missed.
And missed.
Do you want to?
Yeah. Oh, yes, that's a good question, because there's so many wild theories being thrown around, and nobody, I don't think, in the country can answer them as clearly as I can. I mean, that's not very modest, but I have done my research, and I think we can go into this, and we can also go into why is it coming up now. You see, we've done three dialogues here over a four-week period, and there's been a lot of time and a lot of ripples. This is a large strategic military base, the whole peninsula, with Fort Ord and the language school and the Navy postgraduate school and the Kashawa telestar. And there are people monitoring all these programs, and these things go east. And we discussed how I had sent that newsletter out to congressmen in January 1970, and Richard Russell met and gave his press interview. I never thought Oswald did it alone. He was answering me, and last week Richard Nixon made reference and stood in front of the National Archives, and we had just had broadcasts the week before on the National Archives and opening the archives. All of a sudden, Bob Considine on a national column is blaming all the assassination people who are working. He refers to them as the nutty nuts, the mercenaries, the kooks, the assortment of kooks, lonely and fanciful, the crazy people who follow the dead, the bodies, and people like Mark Lane who make a buck out of the murder. Let me say, I've worked 7 years and I've spent $5,000 or $6,000 of my own. We haven't made a buck. Everything we do is free. I mean, it's unreal. So now Bob Considine wants to assure you in one quick blow that Oswald is still the lone assassin, that he didn't want President Kennedy. He was really shooting at Conley. Oswald went into the Marines. He was an agent. He worked in the Soviet Union. And we, showing our anger with him because we couldn't give him a promotion, he had a discharge from the Marines, which is in the 26 volumes of photograph, an honorable discharge. So when he went to the Soviet Union and said, I'm going to live over there and give them my radar secrets, the Navy said, or Marines said, we're going to take it and make it a dishonorable discharge. When Oswald came home, he was ready to go to the University of Texas right after the assassination the next semester and get back to his academic life, and he would be the decoy and be arrested, and then there'd be no evidence, and he'd be off and on his way. It didn't work out that way, and he turned into a patsy. But he did write to Governor Conley, and he had correspondence with Governor Conley. I want my discharge changed from dishonorable to honorable. Now, the letter was sent from Dean Andrews' office in New Orleans while he was still there. He was about to go back to Texas to live after the last jaunt to Mexico. Dean Andrews has colored files for certain clients. There was a pink and an orange hole, depending on which branch of the service. And he had an unusual color on the card file, Lee Oswald. But the complete filing cabinet of Dean Andrews, immediately after the assassination, was lifted and stolen. And that's I have a list of 45 or 50 pieces of direct evidence that have been destroyed or removed. The application of Oswald to Governor Conley has been destroyed. Whatever happened, and Dean Andrews went to jail for perjury in New Orleans in the trial with Garrison. He had no anger with Governor Conley at all. And Marguerite Oswald knows that he didn't. She's living a very quiet life, a studious life, studying, and she has documents, and another researcher in Los Angeles has documents on the relationship of John Connally and Lee Harvey Oswald. That is the specialty of a particular gentleman in Los Angeles that could just blow the nation open when he's ready to get his book out. There was nothing that Lee Oswald had against John Connally, believe me. So, but in the process, I don't think the article, Barbara, was really...
Gloria.
It wasn't really to say that he was shooting at him. It's the last sentence says that he was
capper, yeah.
That he was a lousy shot, and he really wanted, he admits he's a lousy shot, that he wanted John Connally. But the whole article, and it's a long one, is to put down any researchers.
Amazing.
Yeah, we're not going to fall for that. I mean, historically, John Constantine will just be flat on his face because there's an ounce of truth in any sentence that he has written.
Now, one thing I would like you to bring forth is, bring us up to date on James Earl Ray.
Yeah, I think...
The alleged assassinated. Of Martin Luther King.
You see, each week for the last 3 weeks, we've talked about what's in the news. The format is really what is in the news this week, like the Russian papers about blackmail and the balance of power in the country, or James Ray or the John Kennedy. And we'll go through these things. Each week there is something happening, and it's very important. James Ray had no trial, and he was told, if you'll say you're guilty, you'll get life in jail. And the government sent one of their lawyers to represent him, and he was caught in England, and right away he said, I'm guilty. He came home, he had a trial that lasted like 7 seconds, I'm guilty, off he went. He did say to Mr. Huey, the writer, he sent out some letters implicating a conspiracy, and that was the end of that breath. And Ray has been wanting, he's been working with Bud Fensterwald in Washington and other attorneys, wanting to tell what happened at the time of Martin Luther King's death, and who did it, and who gave him his money, and so forth. And we do, it's a pretty heavy trip where he got the money, and other researchers have told me all, I mean, I know all about that. But James Ray, like all the other political assassins, has to be kept isolated. Sirhan Sirhan, Jack Ruby, James Ray, all of them have to be in a room where nobody can see them or talk to them, because if the truth came out of one person spilled the beans, the country would just topple if it could really get out in the news media. But James Ray's brother now feels that he's seen him locked up for 3 years, and he hasn't talked to another human being, and it's inhuman. And just coincidentally, 2 weeks ago, his brother was on a national TV show saying there was a conspiracy and James wants to tell you about it. Now, the brother is the manager of the States Rights Party, a Mr. Stoner, who says he's the only candidate in America representing white people, that he wants all the blacks gassed and killed, and he's come out openly, he represents the white people, he's going to run for president, and his campaign manager is James Ray's brother. Now, James Ray is down in a prison in Tennessee. He's been isolated for 3 years. So this week, it was announced by the warden that James Ray, who was not allowed to mingle with other prisoners, he's been isolated under tight security, will be given the privilege of mingling and mixing with 343 other convicts. Now, the prison population is 40% black. And what you do, you can imagine how popular James Ray. For killing Martin Luther King is one thing. For his brother's position in the States Rights Party is another thing. So now that he wants to talk, now that there's legal procedures and lawsuits in Washington to get the case open, and people are really working on it, and I keep saying, and I've said on the air, and I keep saying to the black population, get out there and go Tennessee, go around the jail, see what James Ray has to tell you. That is where your survival is. Well, by putting him out there, it's like a gladiator at the Roman Coliseum. This is a way to let the black people, 5 or 6, pounce on Ray, not knowing what they're doing, and then they can say, well, he didn't want to be isolated. I fear for his life, like Ruby's. I just don't think he's going to make it. I think this is just a good way to treat political prisoners. They did this in Soledad. There was a man that was very politically active and a Panther, and a young Cleaver coming up the line, and it... This is the origin of the trial of the Soledad brothers. And they have kept the men isolated in the grounds, the whites from the blacks, because of the high pitch of tension. So then one day they said, okay, you guys all go out and play together, have a good time. They went out, and some whites had a confrontation with a black. The guard shot three black men on the spot, the political men in the field. Then there was a repercussion where a guard was killed, and this is the origin of the trial, and there's been moved up to San Francisco, the Soledad Brothers, where they let a confrontation come on the yard. Then they say to protect him from himself, you know, we had to shoot. The men didn't have weapons or anything. You know, there was, they weren't going to kill those three leaders, but that's a good way or a good excuse to wipe them out in the system.
A little drastic, but I guess it, I don't know.
You know, we talk about these ripples. We call them the Carmel ripples. I think they're so near the ocean.
Getting a little bigger.
I think they're getting bigger, and I think we're reaching a really broad base. You know?
We've had more comment from this show than anything we've ever done, and it's gratifying to see people sit down and take the time to write. And one person I know that wrote you said he was writing his three representatives in Congress and the House of Representatives. That's very gratifying to get people moved enough so that they will take action.
Yeah, I think it's important to get people to, I really would appreciate, you know, all of you, whoever your congressman is, and we've gone to this before, or your public officials, explain that here is this person that has done his research on all of these people, and the converging points, the attorneys, the power structure, the people representing them, and the associations they've had, where they've met, how they move. There's so many similarities crossing through that it should come to the national attention. I know it's going to, Gloria. You know, we did a far-out show in San Francisco this weekend for hours and talked, and the calls came in and the responses, and I think the Carmel ripples, it all started here, but things like this Ray case, putting him out now in the field, you'll watch how I predicted my own home, and now I'm going to share it with you. History in the making. You know, I can write to Robert Kennedy and say, go down to Dallas, Ruby just went into a hospital and he's going to die now. Go down and see him because your life is dependent upon what Ruby knows. And he was skiing up at Aspen Christmas holidays and didn't go down, and Ruby was dead January the 2nd, right after the Christmas holidays, and he was dead. And we'll predict, this is one of the things that I'm going to do with you, like I do, I read the papers and I predict trouble for James Ray in Tennessee now.
Mm.
And nobody can say the system killed him because they say he wanted to get out of his cell. So he isn't wanting to talk to the 40% of the blacks down there. He wants his lawyers to get him into a court so he can tell what's happening. But if he wants to see somebody...
Do you think that day will ever come?
No. Well, I shouldn't say that. That's why we're here, isn't it?
Right.
We can't have that thought.
Shall we move to Bobby Kennedy now?
Yeah, well, for 3 weeks we've talked about Bobby Kennedy. You know, it's absolutely fascinating in San Francisco to talk on the air because I could tell them how the San Jose Mercury and the Monterey Herald carried articles on Robert Kennedy and the lawsuits in Los Angeles with the double guns and the gun that was thrown away, the one that the bullets matched in Robert Kennedy and two people, the ambassador. That gun has been thrown away by the police department right after Robert Kennedy's murder. And people in San Francisco were just totally unaware of a lot of these things happening because the Chronicle just isn't covering those stories. But we've been talking for 3 weeks about the Barbara Blair assertion that Mr. Dwayne Wolfer is not fit to be the criminologist in Los Angeles, that he tampers with evidence, aids the prosecution, and doesn't come forth. So as we talk about Bobby Kennedy, the news break, the suit against Evel Younger, our attorney general, and Mariotti, who wants to run for president, the news break of the lawsuits in Los Angeles should have taken Lifetime Newsweek, the mishandling of the weapons. It should have taken the country
you
by storm.
You would think that that would have just canceled out everything else.
It's even on the AP and the UP wire. But no, when I opened Time magazine this week, I was anxious to see, are they covering the Bobby Kennedy? There's a picture of Bobby Kennedy on the floor of the Ambassador Hotel. And instead of putting it under news or political news or assassination department, which they could have, they have an article under behavior. And the title of the article is The Victim Guilty. A psychologist, Richard Evans, in Houston, Texas, said that the victims of political assassinations are seeking assassins, that they're guilty of searching out assassins, that they shape crimes. And he used the example of Kennedy's ambition for power, that he invites attack by offending the offender. Now, that isn't switching it around. If a person in public life is vulnerable, and he is, Gloria, you know, he is vulnerable, why isn't anybody shooting Richard Nixon or Spiro Agnew or Henry Kissinger?
Seems to always be on the left.
That's right. Or Mr. Stoner,
the
state's
vice.
It seems to be a trend that public officials who want real power aren't being bumped off. So you see how the brainwashing continues. This week, we're told that people who go into the Kennedy thing are kooks and nuts. We're told that Robert Kennedy asked for it. None of the real facts, none of the ballistic information that's available to the public is going into the mainstream of this country yet. This is what we have to do, is to find out why Time magazine won't write about the lawsuit in Los Angeles that names the man that shot Robert Kennedy. It names him and names the people who covered it. How far out does Mr. Sherrock have to go? He says where he stood, where he pulled the gun, who saw him, and there's not a boo around the country. Wouldn't he be sued for that? I mean,
that's
frightening. Wouldn't a man who was a maintenance man at Lockheed, who was Robert Kennedy's guard, sue somebody who charged him for murdering the senator? Isn't it strangely quiet there that nothing's being said?
That is frightening.
Yeah. This is the way, this is all this week's news, that Robert Kennedy wanted to be killed and that James Ray wants to be out in the public, so he's going to get his.
Having seen Robert Kennedy at close quarters, I can't agree with that.
Well, I think that what he was doing, if he didn't want the escalation of the war and he was working with minorities and he was taking an unpopular position, you stand a chance that people won't like you or even that they'll kill you. But when you get 20 or 30, 50 deaths down the line that are always the same kind of thinking, that represent the will of the majority instead of a handful of people, you can't really say, these people don't even have power yet.
I have never thought that, you know, like, if I disagree with you, you certainly are not going to kill me. That's not a solution.
Well, it's hardly a solution, and it's bringing us really down on our knees. This country just has to end the continuous murders. Now, out of Morocco is coming the story that the king was so terribly corrupt, he was very much like Diem. And his brother, again, a family thing was involved, and money deals were involved, and he was terribly corrupt. And a group of people, a democratic group, not a communist group, were attempting to take a position there to do something about this particular man. And we play with him because we need the base for the Sixth Fleet and we need our electronic communications there. So we keep the criminals in power because we've made a commitment to these people. So what he did, I understand, was an excuse for a coup. He swiftly organized a thing, it's coming out now, that looked like a coup and then shot his opponents. And they're dead. The leaders are dead. And how many years does it get to get another leader? And Spiro Agnew went there to visit this particular king this week, feeling very safe. You know, like they say, isn't it unsafe to go there? He felt very safe. All the opponents, all the people, not the ones who would even think of killing Spiro Agnew first, but who don't want the king of Morocco to represent them, the land problems, the corrupt poverty, and the deals that they're making, taking the American money in exchange for using that place as a base, the opponents were killed last week. 24 hours, they were lined up and shot.
That's very convenient, but I can't see, you know.
Well, it's a consistent thing. It's a thing of power. People are sitting in a room now and deciding which leaders they will kill, which cover story, and how they'll do it. But what is happening is they're running out of ideas, and there's a format running through all of this. And if you study them carefully...
But that sort of thing can backfire, can it?
Well, I don't know. As long as... This is why we're here, is to tell people what's happening. There's a format running through the death of the musical artists, like Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison. There's no autopsy. They died in their sleep. These are young kids, you know, and Janis Joplin, Otis Redding...
Jimi Hendrix, you know, they said, no, he did not die of an overdose.
And Jim Morrison, it was just a quiet thing. Somebody thanked them for the good days of burying him quietly of a natural cause, and he was in his 20s. We could go another whole day on that subject. But if there's more, if there's 5 or 6 or 8 or 10, and it's always the same kind, and there's no autopsy, and there's no conclusion. You see, I'm using an example now of the musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Where you take 4 or 5, and this is happening. You go on the political assassination, where you get 30 or 40 deaths. and the same people are involved in the same pattern, then you have to know that you're out of coincidence, particularly where all the names are beginning to link.
Right. Now we
should go to New Orleans?
Right along. Yes. Let's go to New Orleans.
New Orleans.
Pick up Jim Garrison.
Everybody's asking about Jim Garrison. I hate to start with today's news, and yet some people didn't hear the back news. Jim Garrison was arrested on a pinball machine, fixing up a pinball game. He has been trying to get the federal government off of his back for a long time, and the newest charge came from a Mr. Gervais who worked with Jim Garrison all the time. They were consistent and good buddies, and they worked on a Clay Shaw case. And Jim Garrison has accused him, wanted to sue him, and the police wouldn't let him. He put a charge of planting evidence against him. And the judge called in Mr. Gervais, and they spoke to him and said, is there any truth to the allegation?
KLRB, Carmel.
Jim Garrison has been threatened or intimidated. Were you threatened or intimidated? He said to Pershing Gervais, the government's witness against Jim Garrison, on the pinball charges, because Garrison said all of these things were planted against him, the federal government's after him. And they said, no, they were not threatened or intimidated at all. They said that Mr. Gervais was introduced through an Internal Revenue Service agent in July 1970 to a Mr. Ball, and Gervais agreed to cooperate with the government in their investigation. July of 70, Mr. Gervais, who was working with Jim Garrison, was met by the Internal Revenue. Well, nothing scares anybody like the Internal Revenue. If they go into your back taxes, it costs you thousands of dollars just to prove you're innocent. You never get refunded back. Or the legal fees or anything. You just have to dig up all your old checks. And the Internal Revenue went to Gervais, who worked with Jim Garrison. And he agreed in July 70 to cooperate with the government against Jim Garrison. Gervais said, when you come up with nothing, we'll work together. They had come up with nothing against Jim Garrison. And he said, this is a quote, when you come up with nothing, then we'll work together. Now, Mr. Wall, who worked with Gervais, quoted Gervais as saying that his motive in agreeing to help the government to get this case against Jim Garrison was the imprisonment of his son in a North Vietnamese prisoner of war camp. Now, I'm quoting the New Orleans State's item, which I take every day. It's dated Friday, July the 9th. 1971, Mr. Gervais agreed to help the government in their case against Jim Garrison because of his motive was the imprisonment of his son in a North Vietnamese camp. Now, many people think if you want to blame the government for killing John Kennedy, that you therefore don't like the war or you're anti-war. The motives are so mixed up in people's minds. Jim's motives in wanting to know who killed John Kennedy had nothing. He did say that the war machine, again, this industrial group from the Southwest and the Pentagon, did use John Kennedy's grave, you know, to escalate. They got full speed. But a man is possible doing anything for his son. I'm not saying that's why he did it, but he says that his motive in doing what he did, in turning on Jim Garrison, was that he had a son who's a prisoner of war. Now, a person is possible, it's possible to be used if your child is a prisoner of war and you want to take a position. It is possible. It is atrocious to read this thing. It's shocking to me to take a personal family thing because your very basic motives are so personal and to agree to put tape recorders or conversations or marked money on a man that you've been working with night and day and agreeing with up to that time. This is what happened in Nazi Germany. You know, you could light the fire or think on your neighbor who was hiding a Jew to save your own child from being taken off. It's a very basic kind of thing, you know, and this really hurts, but he has said it. I didn't, and he said this was his motive in cooperating with the Internal Revenue.
I'm just going to let that sit there.
Yeah, well, Jim isn't working on a reasonable level. There's an emotional thing here now, you know, that a person is capable of doing these things for mixed motives. I mean, his motive, let's put it this way. Mr. Gervais works for the city, for the district attorney's office. and maybe he didn't, that Jim works with the pinball rackets, then his motive is to clean up the pinball.
Right.
His motive is to clean up the crime wave if we want crime out of New Orleans. If it's a very personal level for your son, isn't he serving the New Orleans area? What has his son got to do with it?
This is what I can't connect the two at all.
Well, this is the whole thing. That it's very confusing to people why Jim Garrison is in trouble now, or why people are trying to implicate his name, because all the charges are out against him that he's been up to some hanky-panky in New Orleans to break his credibility. When he corresponds with a charge and says, you lied, you planted, you know you did this or that, I'm suing you for arrest, the judge has a ruling, you can't arrest them because they arrested you first. And it was thrown out. So there's where Jim sits right now, Jim Garrison. And I guess the minds of America will have to believe that he isn't credible. How can he handle this? How, when evidence comes in the otherwise, like I read to you, it's only the New Orleans paper.
It seems to me that it's just too late, you know.
Lori, don't say that.
No, I don't mean giving up hope too late.
Yeah.
You know, like they're doing this a little late. Aren't they trying to break down his credibility?
No, they've done a good job. You know, I think at least 30 people have asked me about books, or I mentioned his book, and the bookstores don't want to carry it. And in the San Francisco area, I mentioned a book by Jim Garrison called Heritage of Stone, and people didn't even know it was out. And these are people that are listening to the program because they're knowledgeable at a certain base to begin with. And there's no advertising of the book. There's no promotion. It's selling. But it isn't late to try and break him down. It's never late. Even Martin Luther King, you know, after he was dead, they tried to smear him and say that he was chasing with other women and break him down. In fact, I brought in, you know, I don't know how many people in this country are aware of a book by John Williams called The Man Who Cried I Am. And it was a novel, but it was a very serious novel, and it was about a plan called the King Alfred Plan to exterminate all blacks in this country. And it was supposed to be based upon a document sneaked out of the government like the Pentagon Papers. And it is a very heavy plan, and nobody knows if it was fiction or fact, and it goes into the killing of Malcolm X because he received this plan. And I have copies of the King Alfred plan, and it was in the novel, but you don't really know whether John Williams made it up to warn black people that we're in trouble or not. But I pulled out the plan this week apropos of something. Sammy Davis Jr. was photographed with Richard Nixon taking a new role in the government. He has been caught positioned on the National Advisory Council on Economic Opportunity. And there's a picture with Richard Nixon. Well, about 2 months ago on Black Journal, I saw Sammy Davis, and he said he had done the Uncle Sam trip, the white trip. He had been with the mafia type in Vegas. He had married the white woman. And he right now, he wanted to help his brothers. He realized that they were in trouble in this country, and he was going to change his whole image and do his own thing and come forward now and try to help the black people where it was really at, because he realized now so many people have been killed and put under that he wanted to identify with where they had been and where they're going. Well, the King Alfred plan mentions, among other things, and I bring this up now because it has to do with smearing Garrison. It says the plan under the Justice Department mentions that we will have dossiers compiled on the leaders of all the organizations, and it lists 12 of them, black organizations in the country. And they will be studied in Washington. And in this, much will be contained in these dossiers, and our threat to reveal that material has considerably held in check the activities of some of their leaders. Leaders who do not have such usable material in their dossiers have been approached to take government posts, mostly as ambassadors or primarily in African countries. Now, what the plan says, they would eliminate a lot of the black leaders, and the others they keep dossiers on. And I'm sure they had dossiers on Martin Luther King, because as soon as he was dead, J. Edgar Hoover had all of his extramarital activities. But then Martin Luther King took this big break and went international. He was national and was reaching out to other shores. He wasn't afraid of the blackmail. But even after death, it wasn't too late, because every time you read about Martin Luther King, it's about those extramarital activities. It's constantly in the news. And maybe when I mention that, you people will read your papers differently and see what is happening. So even after death, they smear. They smear Robert Kennedy and his extramarital activities, that was in the news recently, and we'll go into that. That's another whole day's talk. And interesting, too, because, again, blackmail keeps public officials, I said that the blackmail on Robert Kennedy's activities kept the Kennedy family from really going into who killed John Kennedy. And eventually, these blackmails, if they keep the people quiet, they still kill them anyway. So Garrison, they will smear him and smear him to the, you know, to the grave and thereafter. So it's never too late. His name is not so recognized in this country that people don't believe the smears yet. They believe the smears more than the way he served the country.
It's hard to believe that.
Did you know about the King Alfred plan?
No, I did not.
You've never read it?
No, but I would. I'll make
give
a copy
you,
of it.
Do you want a copy?
Yes.
I'll get one made for you. It's if any of you want to go to a public library, John Williams, The Man Who Cried I Am, it's in the back part of the book, the last 20 pages of the book, has a copy. The whole book is a novel about a man working in the State Department in Europe who gets a hold of this plan, and the final solution is the vaporization. They refer to the blacks as objects, and the final solution is the vaporization of these objects. This is real, but because we put in the realm of fiction question mark, but as I see these black leaders taking certain positions, when they have openly stated another way, I think they're being used. Mm. The plan may still be in effect. So that takes care of Jim Garrison, Gloria.
Right. Let's, before we finish tonight, I do want to talk about Ted Kennedy.
Oh, yeah.
And I see you have an article there entitled 2 years after Chappaquiddick.
After Chappaquiddick, yes. Yes, the Ted Kennedy, we'll go into that really briefly. It's been 2 years since Mary Kopechne drowned, and a large article in the Chronicle this week stated that the Kopechne silence has been remarkable. You can't tell me they don't have unanswered questions. My listening audience, Gloria, I hope that you will see as we go on with these, if we meet every week, everybody is talking about unanswered questions. I have the answers because I think I know who gave Robert Kennedy the concussion. I know that Mary Kopechne was dead
Ted
in the
back.
Ted Kennedy. I'm sorry.
Yes.
There's so many Kennedys. I've got three of them I'm working with now. But the thing, this week, Ted Kennedy had a press conference, and he said he wanted the Pentagon Papers opened up, that even if it did show things about his brother that weren't favorable, he said the people have the right to know. Now, I'm reading a quotation of what came over the paper, Mr. Mollenhoff. It was July 18, 1971. The question that followed after he said people have a right to know was, then why don't you tell your lawyers to permit the Massachusetts grand jury report on the Chappaquiddick matter to be published? One man asked, referring to the investigation, which resulted in the drowning of a young woman. Now, I have a copy of the total inquest of that hearing, the investigation into it. But the grand jury report that preceded it, because the judge says there's something wrong there. They had first a grand jury report that required the inquest. The inquest is public. The grand jury is not. Then it said the serious, confident smile that usually plays around Kennedy's face vanished. Stunned, he turned white. His jaw froze. He stood there for a moment and simply turned and walked out without trying to answer. A pulse settled over the room, and the students started buzzing. Now, the reports this week are the Gallup poll says that Ted Kennedy holds his appeal, that he's way ahead of every other Democrat. But when he talks about the people's right to know, he is holding up a grand jury report. Is he trying to blackmail the people who framed him, and he knows he was framed in that accident thing? The thing was not to kill another Kennedy because the nation could possibly break open, but to damage his credibility as a running mate against Richard Nixon. He cannot live and play that blackmail game any more than Robert Kennedy could. People called in San Francisco, somebody wanted to know, and I'm asked over and over again about the Kennedy family. Why are you doing this if they're not? And I say, I'm not Ethel Kennedy or Rose Kennedy or any of those Kennedys. I don't. I couldn't get into their heads and give you any reason except that he's hiding something. And we as citizens have a right to know. If somebody turns him over, if they want to run him away as a candidate, we want to know. who wanted to know if they're the same people that killed the other two Kennedys. He may use this as a leverage for his being nominated as president. But again, he'll be killed and we'll end up with Henry Jackson or Spiro Agnew. And we don't want that. He's putting us into that position right now. And we want to know what happened to Chappaquiddick. He said we have a right to know. So that's the assassination. If you take each week, like we will be doing, and I think for the people that listen, if you read your papers, there's articles on the Robert Kennedy case in Los Angeles, and on Sirhan, and on James Ray, Chappaquiddick, James Garrison. These are far from dead issues. We don't have enough time to go into the implications of how it's affecting foreign policy today. We'll do more next week. But they're far from dead issues, Gloria. You know that. That's why we're here.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think we still have a little time, May. Do you want to just hit lightly
on little news
in general? A little news in general, or do you want to wait and take Watson up, Manson and Watson up a little later?
Yes, someday I would like to talk seriously for one whole program on the Charlie Manson murder, because it was a political murder. And it was this young boy, Tex Watson, was one of the brightest boys in the Texas school system. And he was a regular churchgoer, and he was an athlete with a high school record that broke all records in the state of Texas. And Charlie Watson was the man who killed everybody in the house at Sharon Tate's house. And he says he did. And he was the one who knifed all these people. He's going to say the girls didn't do it. He hasn't come to a trial. Charlie Manson has been found guilty through a trial that cost Los Angeles $1 million. Charlie Manson has been found guilty of masterminding the Sharon Tate murders, and the man who did the actual stabbings and the killings, the church boy, the American image of the student, the religious boy, the fair-haired establishment boy, did all the killings. And Charlie Manson was approached when he was a prisoner, and we talked like this on another program, while he was at Treasure Island and still a prisoner, most of his life he's been in jails, he was approached by an attorney who was involved in the Sirhan case. Charlie Manson, after being in jails the majority of his years, had a big van. He picked up chicks. He lived off the hog for 17 months. He had credit cards coming down the state using gasoline. Nobody has told us who gave him credit cards. He's never been arrested for stealing. And he has fed this gang and housed them one way or another and had shelter. And my research always goes back to who is paying for these trips. Who bought him that bus? Who pays for the chick's clothes or the food or the transportation? He was never in all this thing apprehended for, neither was Oswald. No jail record, never arrested of having these credit cards. Who gave him the bread? When we know who paid his gasoline on his bus, it will tie in with Tex Walks in Texas. And Manson has been given the death penalty. And now the trial's going to come up for our honor student. He was an athlete, as I say, and the scion of a pioneer ranching family. Handsome, wealthy, and respected. This is out of the San Jose Mercury, Sunday, July 18th. And Charlie Watson will describe that the girls only held the seven people down.
Oh, wasn't Tex Watson declared unfit to stand trial?
Well, Tex Watson was healthy. He was flipped off to Texas where his cousin was in charge of the jail. He was protected by his family. The whole Manson trial went on out here with the girls and Manson. Watson was strong, virile, young, you know, nothing, gung-ho, and good shape. The minute Manson was declared guilty and somebody said, well, Charlie Watson did the killing, let's get him to trial, there was a big extradition thing and they weren't going to bring him out here. There was a hassle whether to bring him out or not bring him out, and this was lengthy. Finally, Reagan used up all of his extradition powers, you know, he wasn't working for to get him here, you know, but it was all used up. The state Supreme Court says, no, he has to stand trial. So he arrived in Los Angeles, and 1 week later, he was a vegetable. The articles where he was in a uterine position, you know, he was rolled up like an infantile fetal position. He had lost lots of weight. He wasn't waking up. He was too sick. All of a sudden, he did well in Texas. He wasn't lying in that fetal position in Texas. But when he came to California, it turned him into a fetus for 1 week. Now he's on his feet, and he's going to use an approach that he was programmed for murder.
That might take a whole program.
Well, I suggest that the legal authorities find out who paid the gasoline for the van, and then maybe that person programmed him. But Charlie wasn't working, so how could he buy the gas? He didn't steal.
Okay, May, I think that's about it for today. Another good one, I think. And we'll do it this time next week. Okay?
Okay.
Listening to Dialogue. Dialogue is a presentation of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department of KLRB News.